Okay, hi. I'm Shonda, as Richard said. And I thought, well, I was just trying to think, so I'm going to try and leave the last 15 minutes or so for you guys to ask questions that occur to you. So I was trying to think of things that were not in my biography that might be useful for you to know as you think of other questions. And this actually ties into the first question I'll answer, I guess, is why did you not continue and complete a master's in physics? So as you have read in the biography, it says that I got a master's in astronomy. And basically, when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, I was a joint concentrator in physics and astronomy and astrophysics. And yes, it is grammatically incorrect on my degree. That's actually what it was. And I wrote a senior thesis in astronomy. I wrote a junior thesis in astronomy. And I went into graduate school thinking that I was really going to do astronomy. I am a strong believer in not separating physics and astronomy out. I think that the quantum gravity can be very well informed by astrophysics, and vice versa. So I've always attempted to kind of straddle the boundary. So that said, that's how I ended up with a master's in astronomy. I originally went into a PhD program in astronomy at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And decided that I wasn't as happy with their theoretical physics group as I would like to be, so I ended up coming here to work with Lee Smolin. So that's basically why I don't have a master's in physics and I have a master's in astronomy instead. So that said, like, if you want to ask questions about straddling the boundary between the two, I just wanted to mention that that is something that I continue to focus on. When I take my qualifying exam this fall, I have three topics, and the three topics will be cosmology, general relativity, and astrophysics. So I'm going to be answering questions about doing calculations about space-times, and I'm also going to be answering questions about how you observe stars and the details about active galactic nuclei. And I really think that a well-rounded theoretical physicist is familiar with all of those things. I guess sort of on the more personal side, I know a lot of people, when they're thinking about choosing a career and thinking about doing a degree in physics, one of the things that comes to mind, and I think particularly for the ladies, is what happens to my family life when I do that. And so I thought I would mention that I did manage to go to graduate school and get married. I have to say that my wife and I have only been married for, how long has it been, Adam, since the wedding, like 5 months? Yeah. And by the way, Adam was like my best man at the wedding. So it can be done. You're allowed to have a life outside of doing physics. My wife is not a physicist. She's not a scientist. She is a tech geek, so I guess we do have that in common. But the point is that you can get outside. So I just wanted to mention that. And if you have questions about that sort of thing, try and keep it in mind for the end. So that said, I have to say that I really liked the question, at the rate at which science is progressing, do you think there will become a point when there will be nothing left to discover, like Star Trek? So I thought actually this... I had a few responses to this question. So I'm a bit of a Trekkie. I'm a big fan of The Next Generation. So first of all, I thought the point of Star Trek was that there were a lot of things that they hadn't discovered, and that's why they sort of zoom around checking out different worlds so that they can learn more. And I think it's sort of a beautiful message that even in a few centuries, we will still be asking questions, there will still be things that we don't understand. So I was saying to someone at lunch, one of the things that we still don't understand is how grain stack and how sand stacks. We don't understand exactly the physics of putting sand in a pile or putting like grains of wheat in a pile. And you know, it's 2008, and sure, we know how to build nuclear bombs, we know how to do these slow light experiments that Lena Howe does at Harvard. We know how to do all this really cool stuff with quantum mechanics, and we know how to do some amazing calculations in string theory and quantum gravity and general relativity, and we can look from a telescope on planet Earth and say extraordinary things about the universe, but we can't go to the beach and exactly explain how that sandcastle stays up. So I think this is a predictor. I'm not omniscient, so I don't really know what the future is going to be like. But my feeling is that there will always be questions out there. For And that part of being curious and part of being a scientist is really about being curious. And so I think part of, I think becoming a scientist is something that is inherent to humanity. There will always be people in the group, and there will always, everyone will always have questions. This is the reason popular science is popular, is because everyone is interested in science. Some people get more interested than others. Some people want to build careers out of it. Some people just want to read about it occasionally. But I think that we are a species that likes to ask questions about what's going on around us, and we're not always good at coming up with the answers in a timely manner. So I think if you're thinking about a career in physics and you're worried that by the time you get your PhD there won't be any questions left, I think that you have bigger things to worry about, like actually finishing your PhD, which actually takes a lot of work. So a couple of people had asked, so another question that was asked is, what sorts of changes to physics as an area of research do you expect in the next decade? So I'm sure at some point, actually I shouldn't say I'm sure, has the Large Hadron Collider been mentioned to you all? Raise your hands if the answer is yes. You know what the Large Hadron Collider is? Okay, so there are some people who don't know. So the Large Hadron Collider is in Switzerland and in France, and it's a particle accelerator, kind of like the one in Fermilab in right outside of Chicago in Illinois. And they are going to be doing experiments at any energy levels that we have never done experiments at. And so this year is actually a very exciting time. I have one of my best friends is one of the scientists who's going to be working on it, and he's actually just finished his PhD at Cornell and is leaving for Switzerland in a month. And he tells me that right now they're cooling it down. They're cooling the system. It's a superconducting machine, so they have to cool it first. And it will probably be turned on and start taking data before the year is out. So a lot of things can happen when we turn on a machine like that. We can get confirmation that the physics that we have predicted is the physics that we indeed see. Or it could be that we're going to see something that isn't at all consistent with the theories that we have and is going to require that we completely, radically change our ideas about physics. And this happens all of the time. When I was in high school in, I think it was in 1998, two teams of astronomers announced that using supernova data, they were able to show that the universe's expansion was actually accelerating. And that radically changed the way that cosmology was done from that point on. We still don't know why the universe is accelerating. You will sometimes hear this referred to as the cosmological constant problem, or the lambda problem, or the cosmology vacuum problem. And the point is that it's now 2008, it's 10 years later, and we still have no clue what's going on with that. So you start to get a sense of sometimes these problems take a long time to solve, and there's no prediction. It could be that right now someone in this building is solving that problem, has come up with an idea that's going to give us the answer to the question, and so tomorrow cosmology could be a completely different field than it was yesterday. But generally speaking, it's not a next day thing. I think probably the last time something like that happened was when Einstein came out with special relativity. I can't think of a more recent example of when everything just suddenly changed. But I do think that trying to make predictions about what's going to happen in physics is a very difficult thing to do. I do think that one thing that has become obvious is that more and more people who have interdisciplinary knowledge are required to proceed, that the boundaries, the traditional boundaries between fields are being blurred. A really good example here in Waterloo would be the Institute for Quantum Computing. For a long time, people were working on quantum mechanics, and for a long time, people were working on computer engineering and designing computers and coding in computers. And really, in the last, I would say, decade or so, we've seen the development of quantum computing and quantum information as independent and very important fields, not just from a theoretical perspective, but from sort of the point of view of modern day consumer technology, that the work that they're doing at the Institute for Quantum Computing and here at Perimeter Institute is going to have a very big impact. So I kind of wonder, I don't know who asked the question, but I kind of wonder if one of the things they were thinking about is, how do I decide what to study if I'm going to go to school in physics? So I think the first thing you should know is that bachelor's programs in physics are pretty standardized, even across country borders. You're going to have to do the same introductory mechanics class and electromagnetism class and multivariable calculus and linear algebra and all of that. Everybody does basically the same thing. So you have a while before you need to start thinking about doing research. I think it's good if you try and do research in the summertime as soon as you can, basically, if you can find someone. Actually, a student from ISSYP last year, who I have continued to be in contact with. I helped him with his college applications and went through the grueling process of helping him decide where to go to university. He's going to Harvard in the fall, by the way. He went to Columbia University and asked a professor if he could go do research with them. And he did some work on gravitational waves during his senior year, and that was part of his senior project. So it's definitely never too early to get involved in research. But you don't have to make a decision about what kind of research you will be doing in the long run for a very long time. And even after you get your PhD, people change. I've known cosmologists who switch to computational neuroscience. There are people who go from doing astrophysics to doing more purely observational astronomy. There are people who go from doing quantum gravity to doing biomedical research and biophysics research. So there are a lot of directions you can go in, and the more educated you are, the better options you have to kind of turn and decide to do something else. So I think what I really want to communicate to you all is that you have a lot of options, and the more you inform yourself and the more you educate yourself and the more you seek out to become informed and educated, the better opportunity you have to not only try new things, but to also change directions. So, for example, in my particular case, I worked in different research areas basically throughout university. My first project was building a board for an actual component, an electronics board with like resistors and capacitors and everything, for one of the experiments at Fermilab, for the collider detector at Fermilab, which is one of the experiments that's been looking for the Higgs particle. And then I went back to Harvard in the fall, and I said, I really don't want to do a high-energy physics experiment because there's a lot of engineering involved, and I don't really want to do engineering work. So I got really interested in the supernova data that had impacted this discovery about the cosmological constant, and I went to one of the professors who did it and said, can I have a job? And so I spent the next year and a half looking at pictures, raw data that they had taken from Hubble, and cleaning them up so that they could use them to take data and try and understand more information. The summer between that, I worked in computational neuroscience and actually had a great time. It was one of the best research projects I ever did. What else did I do? The summer after that, I worked on Lena Howe's slow light experiment at Harvard, and I basically built lasers the entire summer. And for my junior project, I studied sodium content in extrasolar planetary atmospheres. And then for my senior thesis, I studied the structure of active galactic nuclei. So trying to understand the information that we see in different frequencies and trying to construct them into a singular model that actually says this is what a quasar looks like no matter what angle you look at it from. And then when I actually started graduate school, I started doing work in more classical relativity stuff, trying to understand various equations for black holes in different dimensions and something called a black ring that can exist in five dimensions. So the point is that I actually think the goal is to become as informed as possible. So I may stay in quantum gravity, but I can go have a conversation with a planetary astronomer and have some sense of what they do and be versed in what they do. And I think that there is some value in doing that. So Okay, so I think another good question. In terms of schooling and career, what was the hardest choice you had to make in your life? Actually, I thought about this the entire time I was driving here from Toronto. And I have to say, picking graduate schools was extraordinarily hard the first time around. I was admitted to the University of Maryland and UC Santa Cruz in astronomy. Those were the only two astronomy departments I applied to. And Santa Cruz is one of the best departments in the world, and University of Maryland is also a very good place, and basically said that when I got there, I could have, they offered me a huge fellowship, all the money that I wanted, and they said, you can go hang out at Goddard Space Center and pick whatever experiment you want to work on, and we'll just give you the data and you can do what you want. And that was a very, very difficult choice. I'm from California originally, I'm from Los Angeles, and so there was a lot of incentive to go home. But my dad lives in Maryland, so there was also a lot of incentive to go to Maryland from the family side. And so I think as you go along in a career in physics, a lot of the tough choices that you make actually, so there are a couple of things. One, picking what you're going to spend your time doing research on is a very difficult thing. And I think two, picking where you're going to do it is a very difficult thing. And there are a lot of factors that will come into play. So for example, 2 years ago, which is basically actually 2 years ago is when I basically picked up and moved here, and I did it rather suddenly. I was able to make that decision because I was the only person that it impacted. But now I'm married. So if I want to make a decision about where I'm going to go next, there's another person who's involved in that decision. And I have to make sure that Lucy is okay with me deciding to move to the Netherlands or back to the US. Depending on where postdoc opportunities come up or job opportunities come up. So my feeling is that for a lot of physicists, the tough questions frequently involve how you balance your physics career with the other demands on your life. Say you want to be at a university that does a lot of outreach work, but you also want to be at a university that has top-class research. Sometimes those things don't always go hand in hand. Say you're a woman and you want to be in a department that has really gone the extra distance to be friendly to women, has a lot of female graduate students, has a good track record with female undergraduates. There aren't a lot of departments out there that are like that, so that can also constrain you. If you're a person of color and you don't want to live in a small white town, that can also be a challenge. There are all sorts of things that can come up, and those can be very difficult decisions because somewhere along the line, you're probably going to have to sacrifice something. And the question is what you're willing to sacrifice. And I think, you know, that's not necessarily specific to being a physicist or even being an academic. I think that those are the challenges that anyone who wants to be a professional, a specialized professional, a lawyer or a doctor has to think about, like, where do you want to live, what kind of money do you want to make, and that kind of thing. So I think so I don't know if the person who asked that question had something else in mind. Feel free to, like, by the way, you guys can feel free to raise your hand and stop me at any point. If you have questions, please don't feel intimidated. I'll say one more thing. I think a very, very tough thing in physics and in academia in general is if you are interested in doing outreach. Physics is not a community that has traditionally been good about doing outreach. And I'm not specifically talking about diversity. I'm just talking about talking to high school students, talking to the public, getting good at actually doing that kind of communicating. And it continues to be a community that's not always very welcoming or friendly to people who do that kind of work. So as you all know, I've been very involved in the National Society of Black Physicists. And at various points, I've had people challenge me about that work and say, well, you know, do you care more about doing that kind of outreach work, or do you care more about your research? Because, like, if what concerns you is outreach for is creating educational opportunities for Black youth, then you're in the wrong line of work. And so for me, a very difficult thing has been deciding whether I'm going to challenge that statement when it's made to me, whether I'm going to accept it as truth, or whether I'm going to challenge it in the choices that I make. So personally, I have decided to challenge it in the choices that I make. I continue to do my work with NSVP. I think it's one of the most rewarding things that I do with myself. It's also extremely draining and time-consuming at various points, especially when our annual conference is coming up. But on the other hand, it's allowed me to do things that I wouldn't have gotten to do otherwise. So at this year's conference, I got to host Lenny Susskind and Ted Jacobson and a series of other top theoretical physicists. And I got to be, I'm the chair of the cosmology group, and I got to be the person who brought all of those people together and watch as they talked science and interacted in a way that they might, people who generally don't come together because they're working in slightly different veins of theoretical physics. So I think that some of the tough choices that you will make will also have to do with how you respond to peer pressure, both inside the classroom and outside of the classroom. One thing that I've noticed, for example, is people who get lost during a class, like say the professor talks really fast or the professor doesn't know how to teach or whatever, you're going to have a lot of professors who are like that, regardless of what you major in. Like if you major in English, that's probably still going to happen to you occasionally. A lot of times there's going to be pressure not to be the kid who stops the professor every 10 minutes and says, I didn't understand what you said. I was that kid who was afraid to ask questions, and honestly, I think it's one of the stupidest things that I ever did in my life, was not ask questions when I wanted to, because I didn't want to deal with people in the back of the room snickering and people being smart asses about it. So I think one of the things that's very, very tough, but you simply have to get over, first of all, if you're going to be one of those kids who snickers, please reconsider. And if you're that kid who's worried about people snickering at you, they're not worth missing out on your education for. You're there for your education, not for what they think about you. And I think that that is a hump that it sounds, you know, it's easy for me to tell you that, and it's easy to say, yeah, sure, whatever. But it's actually a very hard thing to do. So I think that that's sort of on my list of what has been hard for me in terms of getting over stuff, is that for me, actually, it was challenging to say, okay, like, I have a right to ask the question. I have a right to approach this professor and not deal with people saying, oh, that person's famous, don't approach them. Or, you know, it's not normal for graduate students to sit down with professors at lunch and chat with them like they're normal people. So I think learning to be independent is definitely very much a part of becoming a physicist. And most of the really good physicists that I can think of were all extremely independent people. And that's what allowed them to be so creative, is that they were not beholden to how other people were perceiving them. They were beholden to themselves and how they perceived their ideas and their creativity and their mode of thinking. Okay, so what is another question that I can look at? So what is the hardest thing to becoming a theoretical physicist? I don't know, I think the hardest thing probably is doing the work. Doing theoretical physics is very hard, and in particular, doing quantum gravity is very difficult because we have no idea what we're doing. Like, generally speaking, this is a building filled with people who have no clue. They know a lot, they know how to do physics, they know a lot about physics that we already understand, they know how to do math, they know how to do, you know, very fancy things with equations. But they all have an idea, for the most part, they all have an idea of what the answer to quantum gravity is, but they don't actually know. And there's no data to tell us. This is a very tough time for quantum gravity because there isn't really any data that backs up string theory or that backs up loop quantum gravity. I think in the case of cosmology, we're very lost to answer the questions that are in front of us. So the tough part is trying things anyway, which is basically the tough part is falling out of the saddle repeatedly on a day-to-day basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, and on a yearly basis, and saying, I'm actually having a good time falling off the saddle. Let me get up again and do it again over and over again. And at some point, you will make some progress, or hopefully you will make some progress. But the hard part is, I think, having enough faith in the process and in your belief that you'll make progress at some point to go through the grueling work of actually doing it. And there is something, I think, very glorious about going through and doing the work of doing it, but it's also very hard and it's very frustrating and it will make you think you're stupid and that obviously you're in the wrong field of work because you can't figure out the answer. And so it can feel, it's very tough psychologically, I think, at the end of the day. And then I think the next thing that's very hard about becoming a theoretical physicist is there simply isn't enough money for all of us. So it's very, very hard to get a job. It's hard to get into PhD programs in general. Once you get into a PhD program, it's hard frequently. So if you're not at a place like Waterloo or Perimeter Institute where there's a building full of theoretical physicists, generally at most schools there's going to be, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 high-energy physicists wandering around, and they have very little money to support graduate students, and so they're only going to take 1 or 2 at a time. So you may not be that student they decide to take. That's very difficult. And then, even if you manage to write a thesis in theoretical physics, there's no guarantee that you'll get a postdoc afterwards. And so that's a practical issue that's very difficult. That compounds the psychological difficulties, which is, you know, this is really hard and I'm struggling and graduate school sucks and my advisor doesn't pay enough attention to me or whatever. And then on top of that, like, you're making chump change basically. So you're also incredibly poor unless you're married to someone with a real job, which really helps. And on top of all of this, you're saying, and my job outlook is, well, I don't know if I'm going to have a job when I finish. So I think, and this is my advice for anything that it requires being in school for as long as you have to become a physicist, if you don't love it, don't do it, basically. Graduate school is definitely a labor of love, and pursuing physics and going through the postdoc applications repeatedly every time you have to reapply is a labor of love. So I think that those are probably the things that are most difficult about becoming a theoretical physicist. Okay, let me just keep track of which ones. Okay, so I guess like I'll tack on to that. What is the salary range of a physicist? That really depends on a lot of things. So if you're in graduate school and you have the misfortune of going to graduate school in Canada instead of in the United States, then your income can be as low as $12,000 a year. So if you go to graduate school, in the United States, you're looking at something like $18,000, somewhere between $18,000 and $21,000 a year. For a first postdoc, you're looking at something like $30,000. And unless you come to PI, in which case you're looking at $60,000. But yeah.
What is postdoc?
Okay, sorry. Thank you for asking. That's a really good question. So basically, for a career in physics, you're going to start. Do you guys have a question? Okay. You get your undergraduate degree. Then you'll pursue graduate degrees. If you apply to programs in the United States, you apply to PhD programs straight out of your first degree. If you go to school in Canada, you apply to master's programs, and then at the end of your master's program, you apply for a PhD program. But basically, they turn out to be the same. At the end of the day, you have a PhD. So the next position that most people go into, if they're continuing to stay in academia with a PhD, is that they get something that is called a postdoctoral position or a postdoctoral fellowship. And these are generally somewhere between 1 and 3 years in length. And they're full-time research positions. Most of the time, you're assigned to a faculty member, and that faculty member has a lot of control over what you work on. And it's considered a time when you're really supposed to prove yourself as a researcher.
So it's your duty?
No, I'm a graduate student, so I'm a PhD student. Yeah. So the next thing that I will be looking at next year, I'll be applying for postdoctoral positions.
Okay.
Yeah. Some people get lucky enough to go straight into faculty positions after they finish graduate school. I have a friend from Santa Cruz who's going to be junior faculty at the University of Texas at Austin. She's taking a year off to do a fellowship first, but she's going to be starting next in the fall of 2009. As junior faculty straight out of graduate school. That is extremely rare, particularly in physics. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that they say about being a postdoc is publish or perish, basically. So you need to keep publishing papers, and this will help you. Generally, people do multiple postdocs. They don't just do one or two. But as they get further along in postdocs, they're starting to try and apply for faculty positions. And if they get an offer from a university that they like enough to actually take it, then they'll stop being a postdoc and they'll move into a faculty position. But becoming faculty does generally mean that you have to teach. And so something that some people consider to be nice about being a postdoc is that most of the time you don't have to do teaching. I think that this is very unfortunate. I would want to teach. But a lot of people avoid teaching like the plague. So that's sort of, so that's basically the laydown for a postdoc. So for junior faculty, they will start anywhere between $40,000 and $60,000 a year. And senior faculty, it really depends on like how many awards you've won and how big your name is and whether you publish a book and you're getting royalties off from that book. So you could be senior faculty and making somewhere between $70,000 and $1 million a year. And the $1 million in particular, I'm thinking of Steve Weinberg when he was considering moving to the University of Texas at Austin, asked what the head football coach made. And of course, Texas is a big football school. And they told him the number, and he said, well, I want to make at least as much as the football coach is making. And so I think he ended up with a salary of $1 million a year. And Texas happens to be a school that's oil rich. They own a lot of oil land. And so they actually had a large enough endowment to be able to afford that. I know that the faculty at PI are fairly well compensated. I think six digits is a starting place for faculty. But PI is extraordinarily rich compared to most places where physics is done, and so I wouldn't consider that the norm. But it really depends on whether you're the kind of person that a school really wants to have, and in some sense, how well you sell yourself. So, but I want to emphasize that nobody goes into physics for the money. Like, this is, if money making is your priority, then this is not the line of work for you. But I think that most people who choose physics over a career where they can make a lot of money find that they're very happy with the life that they choose because they're doing something that they love very much. And as I said, physics is really a labor of love. So I don't necessarily think that they've made a poor decision, but obviously it's up to you. So in conjunction, somebody asked what job opportunities, if you have a physics degree, are. So a lot of physicists go into finance because a lot of the mathematics is the same. So if you're interested in working on Wall Street, for example, and you have especially a master's, although some people come out with a bachelor's too and go right to Wall Street, that is an opportunity. But I'm not the person to ask about that because obviously I chose the poor route instead. So, but there are other job opportunities out there. So I also should mention that there were a few questions in here that were specifically like physics questions, like what is micro non-locality, and what do you think of this claim about quantum tunneling? And I'm going to say that I'm probably not going to answer questions like that here because it would actually take up a lot of time for me to answer them, and there are a lot of other questions that I want to get to. But I really encourage the people who have physics questions to come talk to me afterwards, or also to look up my email address on the website and send me an email, and we can certainly sit down and have lunch next week, for example, and talk about it. So I was really pleased to see, I want to mention to you all that last year there were no questions about women in physics. And this year, there were three or four questions about what it's like to be a woman in physics. And I guess Adam told me that he sort of encouraged you guys to know that it was OK, like if you wanted to ask questions about that. And I mentioned to you one of the female postdocs here that I had gotten these questions. And she was really happy as well to know that young women are asking these questions. So I would have to say that when I was an undergraduate, I feel like I got lucky in some sense. I didn't have, for the most part, any really serious experiences with sexism. I did have to sit through a few study groups where the guys made jokes that made me really uncomfortable, and that really sucked. And I think that probably a lot of women are always very concerned about being labeled as being difficult, and so they're afraid to speak up and say, you know what, that joke was really inappropriate, that joke made me uncomfortable, or, you know, like, I'm here to study, I don't want you to hit on me, or whatever, or like, and I think that that's unfortunate, and that it's a difficult situation, in the sense that, like, I would love to just say, you know what, feel comfortable speaking up for yourself and just do it. And absolutely, I think you should never, if you feel like that's what's right for you, then I think that you should always feel encouraged to do it. But I also understand that, like, you have to live with these guys for the 4 years that you're an undergrad, and that there are, for the most part, a lot of men who are not going to act like that. And so, one, it's important to seek those guys out and make them your friends and your study partners. I had a lot of, most of my friends actually are guys, and several of them are physicists. And they're extremely supportive, and when I have gotten comments that I really haven't appreciated, they're the people I've gone and said, you know, I really don't understand that. And it's reassuring to know that these guys understand that what I'm going through. So I think a lot of what goes on in physics when you talk about sexism is much more subtle. It's not so much a guy is going to walk up to you and be like, hey, you're a girl, you shouldn't be doing physics. Like, I don't think that that happens as often. I do have female friends who've had things like that happen to them in fairly recent times. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen. And so I would also like to say for all the guys in the room, if a girl comes to you and says, blah, 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 said X to me, take it seriously, because these things do still happen. And one of the most difficult parts for the women who do confront those situations is often their experience is not taken seriously. And people think that they're being oversensitive, that they're making it up, that they're misinterpreting, that they don't have a sense of humor, et cetera. You know, like, at the end of the day, if someone says to you, something really hurt me, it's not very nice to tell them that, whatever it is, it's not very nice to tell them, well, your experience, you know, it's your fault, the sort of blame the victim mentality. And that is something that women run into a lot. So I think that, in my observation, that's one of the challenges that women run into. But there are other things that go on, in particular when you're thinking about career path stuff. Having a baby, and when do you have a baby, is a very, very difficult question to sort out. And it depends on so if you decide you're going to do it in graduate school, how you will be treated will really depend on the graduate program you're in. So for example, UC Santa Cruz is an ideal place to do it because it's a very progressive school. It's a school with a lot of support built in for women. And it's a school where people would certainly speak out if a woman was being treated poorly. If you're at a school that isn't as supportive, then you might say, okay, I'm going to wait until I'm in my next position. So maybe you decide to do it at the beginning of your postdoc because you're postdocing at a place that's very flexible about schedule. I know of a place that has had a very unfortunate incident with this fairly recently, that a woman had a baby, was told that she would be assisted with childcare, and in the end, the workplace has been extremely nasty to her and very disappointing. And so that does happen. On the other hand, there are a lot of women who do manage to deal with it, and this particular person did manage to deal with that, and partly it was because she had a husband who's also a physicist, who is extremely conscientious, and didn't want his wife's career to be ruined just because biologically she was the one who had to have the kid and not him. So I think that that is one of the major challenges, that a lot of these things haven't really been sorted out. You know, if someone does come to you and say, you know what, like, I just think, you know, women aren't as smart as men, or someone comes and persistently harasses you and says, and persistently makes comments to you that make you feel uncomfortable, going to complain about it is a very complicated question. Sure, you can approach human resources about it, and human resources, at least in Canada by law, is required to deal with it. But you do have to deal with people saying later, you overreacted. You have to deal with people who didn't like how you handled the situation, who later have the opportunity to make decisions about your future because they're reading your job applications, postdoc applications, faculty applications, who then use it against you. And that is something that does come up. OK, so I've made things sound pretty bleak. Sure.
If you're not affecting them more, like you're applying for your postdoc, you're applying for a position, and like, is it common or like significant enough that some men in the position wouldn't choose you for it, like to be studying for a PhD or something?
I can't say how common it is. It's very hard to measure these things because for the most part, people won't own up to it, right? But I can tell you that I know for a fact that it has happened. I know it happened in the Harvard Astronomy Department the year that I applied to graduate schools. They got 100 applications for the PhD program, and 50 of them were from women. And they ranked their applicants by quality. And when they were done ranking, all but two of the women were in the bottom 50% and were basically out of the running to be admitted to the program. And the two who were in the top were extraordinary. They had a ridiculous number of publications for an undergraduate student. They had incredibly high GRE scores. They had the best grades. They were basically the two best applicants in the pool, and therefore were very hard to ignore. And I heard this story because the Harvard Center for Astrophysics is actually the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And the Smithsonian people are very involved in outreach and have really made an effort. They actually have an education department that studies women in physics. And they had gone to a conference about women in physics and had come back and done a report back. And one of the junior faculty who was on the admissions committee had told this story to the group. And so I later went to him and said, you know, part of the problem is that Harvard emphasizes test scores and grades way too much in the application process. And we know now that there are studies that if you take a girl who had AP physics or AP calculus in high school and AP physics, and a guy, and they got the exact same grades on the exam, same grades in the class, you put them in a calculus-based introductory physics program, and statistically, the girl's grade is lower. And we don't really understand why that is. We don't know if it's because there's less protection for women in the classroom at the undergraduate level. But the point is that there are these biases. And it's also true with the GRE. And on top of it, just so you guys know, the GRE, they know there's no correlation between your GRE score and the quality of research that you're going to do. What it does correlate with is how well you will do on a qualifying exam, which is why universities look at it. But personally, I think it's a bit stupid because good researchers are not always great test takers, and who knows how many researchers are not helping us solve these problems we can't figure out because we homogenize by selecting for a certain type of thinker. So I went to this professor privately later, and I said, you know, I'm going to Santa Cruz in the fall, and I didn't have the top grades in my class, and I didn't have the best GRE scores, but I am going to one of the best astronomy programs in the world. And my entering class will have 7 people in it, and 4 of them will be women, and 3 of them will be men. So obviously, it can be done, and the question is, why is Santa Cruz doing it and Harvard isn't? And his response was, his response was a little bit idiotic. He said that Harvard is Harvard and Santa Cruz is Santa Cruz, which is all well and good, but it continues to be that when you look at paper references and et cetera, Santa Cruz researchers get referenced more than Harvard researchers do in astronomy, and that's just the breaks for Harvard's astronomy department. But he also went on to say that one of the faculty members who is on the admissions committee felt strongly that women did not belong in graduate programs. And this guy was making decisions about how 50 women would be ranked, right? So, okay, so you could say that's just Harvard. But it's also true that a lot of schools take their cues from how schools like Harvard and Princeton and Yale do things. And given the history, I think, and so this is me, I guess, functioning like a physicist, is I'll extrapolate from the data that I have, that this is probably not the only time and the only place that it has happened. So it does happen. But so before you ask your question, what I wanted to say is that things do sound pretty bleak when they're put like that. It's worth noting that more and more people are becoming conscious of these problems, that people are becoming aware that despite the fact that there's been a lot of progress, that there are more women in physics now than there were 50 years ago, say, that there are still a lot of problems that confront them. More and more people are developing mentoring networks and resources to help women get through. So again, this is an example. So there are very similar stories when talking about Black students, and this is one of the reasons that I got so involved in the National Society of Black Physicists. It gives me an opportunity to help provide that mentoring and provide that support base that really does help get people through. In particular, like I'll say, every Black woman I know who is in a PhD program in physics or has earned a PhD in physics had someone pull her aside at some point and say, "You will not make it." Every single one of us has had someone pull them aside, a professor, like a well-known professor, a professor in their department who knew them well, and say, "I don't think you should apply to graduate programs. You're not going to make it as a physicist." And these women have PhDs from places like MIT and Stanford. These are not, you know, women who hadn't proven themselves at a very high level. Those things do happen, and I think sometimes people are not always conscious of the fact that they're doing it. There may be a professor who says, "Well, I just like to pull students who I don't think are going to succeed aside." And he just happens to pull the women aside, and he doesn't even realize that for the most part, that's who he talks to about it. Part of it is getting to people to just be more conscious of their own behavior. And so a lot of it has to do, so I think, having said all of that, I think the most important thing is that if you're considering being a woman in physics, don't be afraid to seek out the other women who are in your year and in your program. And don't be afraid to seek out the women who are a couple of years ahead of you and have, you know, gone through the courses that you're taking right now. And say, like, "Let's form a study group together. Let's work together. Let's be friends." Like, if they're the sort of person that you connect with, build that support for yourself. And don't be afraid to use it. And I think that the women who get through are either the ones who find a way to act like the guys and fit in, and nobody ever challenges them because, like, they're one of the boys. And then there's also the group of women who really build support networks for themselves and then are very smart about using that support network. And having said that, I think that's true for anybody. Probably in any career, that building support networks for yourself is really important. So if you're really close with one of your parents, being able to call them, like when you're really freaked out about your midterm, and just say, "Mom, like, can I cry on the phone with you for 15 minutes? Or, "Dad, can I vent at you for 15 minutes? Like, I have this experience in my study group. I'm very, very upset." And not being afraid to say, "I need help. I'm not handling this as well as I could." Going to counseling services when you need to. All of that kind of stuff is very important no matter what avenue you decide to pursue, that it's important to be able to say, "I need help, I don't know what I'm doing, I can't handle this situation." So, and I think that that's particularly true for people who are from groups that are traditionally underrepresented and groups who are traditionally targeted because they're underrepresented. But, you know, the thing is that, so the National Society of Black Physicists started 32 years ago, and it started as a group of like 10 Black students at MIT sitting down and going, "Okay, there are a lot of problems and we have to do something about it." So that was the first meeting of NSBP. It was like 10 students or something like that. And it's now 32 years later, and our annual conference has an attendance of about 500 people. And I would say So there are a lot of recruiters who come, and not everybody who's there is Black. It's a joint conference with the National Society of Hispanic Physicists. But the point is that when people do get together and build those networks, they grow over time, and they make a lot of changes. So there's a lot of reason to be very hopeful about the situation. So as bleak as the stories I've told you have sounded, and it's definitely important to be conscious of what's going on, I think there's a real argument there for getting involved in outreach and in the community around you, because it really does make a difference, and you never know what kind of impact you're going to make. For example, the student that I've been mentoring, who was an ISSYP last year, he found me because he had read an entry that I wrote on cosmic variance about diversity in physics. And he came to me and said that it had been very, very important for him to read that entry and had really helped him deal with a couple of things that were going on at school. You never know when you're just going to say something really nice to someone that's going to like help them get through the day. So I think generally speaking, I would like to see more of that in physics, and I think it's particularly incumbent on people who are concerned about these kinds of struggles to really go out there and be that person who provides support for people. So one question I got was, how old were you when you started to read any physics literature? So I'm not really sure what you mean by physics literature. Like, so if you're talking about popular science, I first got interested in doing physics when I was 10 years old. My mom took me to see the movie, the documentary, A Brief History of Time, and I didn't want to go see it. Like, I went into the movie theater, and my mom kind of had to drag me, and you know how 10-year-olds are. So, but at some point in the middle of the movie, I was just awestruck, and I said, this is where I want to be, and this is like what I want to be doing. And I came out of the theater begging my mom for a copy of the book, which she was scared to buy for me because she was afraid I wouldn't understand it and would become discouraged. And so my uncle bought it for me. And I read it, I would say, once a year for the next 4 years. And there were a lot of things I didn't understand, but it kept me kind of going. I didn't really start looking at scientific literature until I was a freshman in college. And I got really lucky. The first research mentor I had in high energy physics experiment, I'm the particle physics guy. He's actually a professor I still go to, and I have questions about like making career choices, about how to handle a situation. He sat down and said, okay, these were the problems that I had, and this is how I will help you avoid the problems that I had. So that's sort of my trajectory. I really hate the idea that, you know, we like to glorify theoretical physicists, like, oh, this one, he was very special, obviously, from when he was 5 years old, it was obvious he was going to be a genius and that sort of thing. You know, there are a couple of people like that. It's also very common that we like to turn true stories into mythology and make them sort of more grandiose than they were to start with. But most progress in physics has been made by thousands of people whose names you have never heard and probably will never hear, who came from all walks of life, who got interested in physics at all stages. I think this is true, and this is even true, I think, of famous people who have done really well in certain fields. Like, one of my favorite examples is Mikhail Baryshnikov, who is possibly one of, in my opinion, he's the greatest ballet dancer of the 20th century, but some people might feel differently about Nureyev. But he came to ballet very late in the game. He was like something 16 or 17 when he started dancing, and he was an athlete before that. You never know who is going to bring a fresh perspective to the kind of work that is being done. So you could be in this room right now and then walk out and say, you know what, I really love studying romantic poetry and I think I'm going to major in English. And then somewhere down the line say, you know what, I want to do a degree in English and physics. And if you're willing to put the time into it, I absolutely say do it. You don't just have to be interested in physics to be a physicist. You don't have to be one of those kids who like slept with like equations in your brain and like you had all of these dreams and all of this. Physics, yes, to a certain extent, is about talent, but for the most part, I think everybody has that talent. It's the talent of being inquisitive and curious and persistent. Physics is so much about persistence and about the hard work to back persistence. So I think if talent has anything to do with success in physics, it's like 10%. The rest of it is whether you're willing to sit and think about the same problem for weeks and months and years on end. And that's absolutely what Einstein did. You know, Einstein, he was a very smart guy who also had a lot of problems at school, getting along with his professors, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, he did end up doing his best work away from the physics community, partly because they were being very closed-minded at the time. But it's also true that, so first of all, he had a wife who did all of the cooking and cleaning so that he could like sit around and think. It really helps when there's someone who does all of the housework and does all of the other stuff that needs to be taken care of in the day-to-day life to allow you to sit around and think. And I have to say that I've been extremely lucky. I have a wife who loves to cook, absolutely loves to cook. And that means that every night I can sit around and do my research and devote a lot of time to my research and not worry about cooking dinner. She loves to go to the supermarket. Like, seriously, I have to call her up and be like, dude, come home, stop looking at all of the different like specialty meats or whatever. It's very nice. I don't know what I would do with a partner who expected me to be the person to, who did all of the cooking and cleaning and to be more traditional in our gender roles. So I think a lot of it has to do with having, again, the right support from your family and your friends and the people around you, and then you being willing to put yourself to the task and focus on it. So I really want to make that clear. That I'm not one of those people. I think it's worth saying that physics, for the most part, is a collective enterprise. People like to talk about, you know, Einstein did this, and Einstein did special relativity, and Einstein did general relativity. Einstein couldn't do most of the math, and he had a group of mathematicians around him who really filled in the blanks. And when he couldn't fill, when he couldn't come up with a way of thinking about something, who offered him suggestions. And in my mind, relativity is as much their theory as it is his. Certainly, he was the leader in some sense. But it's very, very rare that a theory is developed by one person. And so I think that this is a very common myth about physics, that, you know, it's all people sitting by themselves, you know, generating equations and being geniuses. And what it really is people sitting down by themselves, getting frustrated and not figuring out the answer and going down the hall and saying, hey, can you figure it out? And then the two of them talking about it and maybe deciding that the question was asked poorly and coming up with a completely different avenue for thinking about the problem. And that's what, for the most part, research in physics is about collaboration. And I think if there's anything that you take away from, like, what is it like to be a physicist? For me, being a physicist is, yes, being very independent and not letting other people tell me what to think, but it's also being extremely open-minded and listening to what other people have to say. And if I'm going to disagree with them, being able to verbalize to myself why I disagree with them and being able to explain it to other people why I disagree with them. But it's a very interactive enterprise. And for the most part, if you try and work alone, you won't get very far. So I think it doesn't matter. Like, I'm sure there's some people in this room who have been interested in physics for a very, very long time and have read all of Brian Greene's books and have read Stephen Hawking's books, and that's great. If that's what you've been spending your time on, that's great. When I was in high school, I carried the complete works of Shakespeare to school every day for 2 years, and I read all of his plays. I wasn't reading Brian Greene when I was in high school. I wasn't doing a lot of that stuff. I was learning Shakespeare and Austen and reading John Steinbeck and developing a very deep appreciation for history, studying US history and European history. And I continue to spend a lot of my free time on those things. So there's nothing wrong with being well-rounded. There's nothing wrong with not being the nerd in the room. And there's nothing wrong with being the nerd in the room. But that's not what will define you as a physicist. What will define you as a physicist is whether you put the work into doing physics and being interested in physics when the time comes. But I think that this idea that you can judge whether someone is physics material or not based on like how they spend their free time is very old-fashioned and hopefully very much out of fashion. So someone said, I'm interested in the mysteries of the universe, space and time, stuff like that. It's the hardest part of physics, right? So I'm sure some condensed matter theorist or experimentalist would pummel any high energy theorist who said that. So look, there are a lot of high energy theorists who really do think that they're the cream of the crop, a lot. I think they're full of it for the most part. Everyone who's working on physics has something to contribute. And for the most part, those people who are doing other things are contributing to the greater community much faster than the rest of us are. So, I could come up with a solution for quantum gravity, and it might be a while before that had any impact on the rest of humanity. But someone who works on superconductors, for example, they're making a real impact in the technology of our society. One of the professors from the National Society of Black Physicists that I have a very close relationship with is an expert in medical physics. So he does a lot of work with nuclear imaging. And he's having a real impact in how we will be able to diagnose and image people that will save lives. So I think the question of what's hard, it's really hard, is being an experimentalist being a graduate student in experimental physics and your professor expects you to be in the lab somewhere between 60 and 80 hours a week. That's tough. It's physically grueling. It's psychologically grueling. It's hard being awake for those long hours. Sometimes you have to work in rooms that are hyper air conditioned because of the needs of the equipment, and so your fingers are always freezing, and you can't wear gloves because you can't contaminate the lenses, etc. And sometimes your experiment's not working and you have no idea why, because on paper everything looks fine. And it turns out that it's because it's sensitive to the vibrations from trucks on the street, like 300 yards away. You have to be very good at working with instrumentation to be a good experimentalist, just like you have to be very good at doing thought experiments to be a good theoretical physicist who focuses on general relativity. They are different kinds of talent, but they're no less valuable one or the other. I worked in the lab on multiple occasions. So I had to do my astrophysics lab my third year, and one of the experiments that I had to do was calibrate a CCD, like the one that's used on the Chandra X-ray telescope, and I was doing it with the guys who had calibrated the one that was actually on the telescope. And I sucked. Like, I had no intuition for how things worked in the lab. I didn't really have a good intuition for how to work with the machines, like what I could and could not do, because when I was a kid, like, sure, I played with Legos, but I spent most of my time with books, and that was the intuition that I had developed, was how to think about things. I hadn't developed an intuition for how to think with my hands. And someone who's a good experimentalist is someone who thinks with their hands, I think. Now, that said, I got the highest grade in my quantum mechanics and my general relativity courses, and my lab partner didn't. We had different kinds of talent, but that didn't mean that I was smarter than her, or she was smarter than me. It meant that it's better that she went into observational astronomy and that I went into theoretical physics, because that's probably where we're best suited to make contributions. So I'd like to defeat the idea that there's more glory in pursuing one or the other. It's true that publicly, theoretical physicists, particularly people who think about the cosmos, get all of the attention, and believe me, there are a lot of physicists who are very bitter about that. But that shouldn't be why you choose what you do. You don't become a physicist because you want to be famous. You become a musician because you want to be famous. And it turns out these days you don't actually have to have much talent to do that. So pretty much anybody can do that, I think, at this stage. So yes, it's hard, but I think all of physics is hard. There isn't an area of physics that is easier when it actually comes to the science. Now, there are differences in community, and some communities are easier to get along in than others. So it's easier to get a job in condensed matter than it is to get in quantum gravity, and that simply is because there's just more funding out there, because in some sense it's more of a practical science. I have found, by and large, the astronomy community is a much more friendly place than the physics community, which is actually the reason I went to graduate school in astronomy originally, is I wanted to be around nice people, and the astronomers seemed nice, and the physicists didn't. So that was kind of, but of course, like, those are generalizations, and some of my closest friends are extraordinarily generous and kind physicists. So, but it is true there can be differences in the communities, and one of the tough decisions that you'll make as you go along is whether how the community functions will be a dominant factor in which community you decide to be part of. So, one more question that I'll look at, and then hopefully you guys have some questions that you want to ask that you hadn't thought to ask yesterday. So what is it like to be a physics major in a university? So generally speaking, your first year, you're going to take a course in mechanics, an introduction to mechanics. In England, I think they tend, and actually in several parts of Europe, they tend to separate out people who want to do theory and people who want to do experiment. In North America, that generally speaking doesn't happen, so everybody takes basically the same intro mechanics course. Then you'll move on to introductory electromagnetism, and then something like an introductory waves and or optics course. So when I was at Harvard, the content of the wave slash optics course really depended on the professor. If you got Howard Georgi, who's a theoretical physicist, it was a waves course. And if you were like me and you got Papaliolios, it was an optics course because he was an optics expert. Then generally speaking, you're going to go into a quantum mechanics course, and then you're looking at either the beginning or the second half of your second year. And after that, you should really take an advanced classical mechanics class and an advanced electromagnetism course and try and take a second term of quantum mechanics. And then you have some flexibility. Maybe you are interested in doing astrophysics as well, so you take a couple of astrophysics courses. And that's basically the lay of the land. I'll tell you flat out, I was really bored for the first 2 years of college in physics. Like, you know, I had spent 6 years going, I really want to be a physicist. And I got to college and, you know, who cares about a pendulum swinging back and forth and balls rolling down inclines? And, like, and you know, to an extent, like, it's cool if you actually see one, like if they bring one into the classroom and show it to you. But Harvard didn't do things like that. So it was all very, you know, read a textbook and, you know, worry about pulleys. And for the most part, I didn't care about pulleys. What I wanted to get to was the cool stuff, like how you understand black holes and all of this other stuff. I think that that's a really good argument for pursuing research as early as possible, or finding a professor who will just let you hang out in their lab and like tinker with stuff so that you get some hands-on experience with doing physics early on. If you go to a school that has very good labs, you might end up enjoying the lab components of the classes. But I think I would say don't take introductory physics as a first measure of what doing physics is really like. If you're taking AP physics next year, or you took it last year, or IB physics, those classes for the most part have almost nothing to do with what with being a physicist is actually really like. Unless you have a cool teacher who has really put the effort into bringing some cool setups into the lab, and bringing information from the outside world into the lab. But for the most part, Newtonian mechanics, it is very, very important, which it took me years to understand, very important to realize that all of the stuff you learn in that class, you will use every single day for the rest of your physics life. But the way it's going to be applied in those classes is not going to be very exciting, and that's just the breaks. So part of it is that you kind of have to pay your dues to the past so that you can get to the future. And I think that that's the way to think about it with physics. So, you know, say in a year and a half, you decide you're going to major in physics, you're going to take that intro mechanics course, and now you won't be shocked if it's not terribly entertaining for you, and you will be pleasantly surprised if you have a good professor who puts the effort into making the material interesting. And hopefully you'll remember what I've said here and not take it as a judgment on physics. Okay, so I think I will stop now and see if anyone has questions that they want to ask. Otherwise, I can answer a couple more. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, are there any other interests that you feel like you may have left behind by pursuing physics?
That's a good question. So my senior year, we have general distribution requirements, and to fulfill my history A requirement, I took a course on the French Revolution. And I loved it. I really, really loved it. And I did really well on the course. And I went to the professor at the end of the course to drop something off. And he looked at my grade and he said, oh, well, you only got an A minus. And I said, well, I am a thesis writing senior in physics. And he said, well, you know, you really should consider looking at history instead of doing physics. And then it turned out my TA pulled me aside not long after that and said, you know, I really think you should reconsider your application to graduate school in physics, and you should consider applying to graduate school in history instead. And I think that you would have fun and that it would be very good. And since moving to Canada, I've gotten very interested in Afro-Canadian studies, and I certainly wish that I had more time to put into that. I think probably for anyone, no matter what job you choose, like if you become a lawyer, it's very time consuming. You become a doctor, it's very time consuming. You become a teacher, and it's like way more time consuming than I think students realize. Because those teachers take their work home, and they're working until like 8 p.m., working out like their lessons for the next day and that sort of thing. There's always something that you want to put more time into. Just because the economy says that everybody has to work 8 to 12 hours a day on a job doesn't mean that that's actually how humans function psychologically. It's not necessarily like ideal. People have multiple interests, and to an extent, one of the misfortunes of the economy as it stands is that it doesn't allow people to be multidimensional in that way. So certainly, another thing that I wish it's at various points that I could take like 2 months off, especially the month before the National Society of Black Physicists, and just focus on getting all of my scheduling done and focus on working on the outreach that we do before the conference. I wish that I could take time to focus on doing those sorts of things. One thing that I would really like to do is spend more time designing curricula that get kids interested in physics at a younger age. And frequently there's a trade-off. Particularly if you're in graduate school, professors do not like it at all if you show interest in anything other than physics. And so part of the trade-off is saying, okay, my professor's mad at me right now, and that's the side I'm going to take. But to an extent, sometimes it involves saying to yourself, this is something I love and I care about, and I just can't put the time into it. That's certainly true, for example, the graduate students at the University of Waterloo really need a union. They really need a union. And at the University of California, we have one, which I was an officer in. And something I would love to put time into is going around and getting the signatures of graduate students on cards to do a union vote. But I just don't have time for it. And as much as I think it's an important job, and if a group of people came to me and said, we're very interested in working on this with you, I would put time into it, it's not something I can lead myself. And so there are all sorts of things that I'm very passionate about that I have to take a back seat. I'm also a bad person to ask about this in some sense, because I am probably more flexible about this than most other people are. And then part of it is just like fitting things into your schedule. So recently I took up chess, and I have a chess instructor, and I take lessons and fit them into my schedule as I can. And so trying to fit things in. So Peter, the student for my SSYP last year, asks me all the time, Chanda, how do you do all of the stuff that you do? And I will say, Lucy, my wife, she does a lot of the things that need to be done so that I don't have to. And she's very, very, very key to that success. And so I hope, like, as people find partners and think about the role that your partner will play in helping you build your career, that you recognize the extraordinary amount of, like, housework and emotional housework that other people will do, including your parents. Like, the parents who, maybe you have a parent who works extra hours so that you don't have to get an after-school job, which is what my mom did, so that I could go to a good high school. That people around you will make sacrifices that will help you do what you need to do. And that will, in some sense, be determinant of what gets left behind and what doesn't. Any other questions? Seriously, complete silence. I didn't say anything controversial. You guys are allowed to disagree with me, by the way.
So what would a theoretical physicist actually do during the day? Just
okay. Sure, this I'm sorry. So it depends on the day. So for example, today I'm here talking to you all. So I've driven from Toronto because my wife works in Toronto, so I spend most of the week there. And frankly, it's a nicer place to live than Waterloo. So a lot of people at Perimeter spend as much time in Toronto as possible, we included. When I'm done here, I'm going to go talk to Faye Dowker, who is visiting from Imperial College in London, and I'm going to talk to Joe Henson, who used to be her PhD student, is now a postdoc at Perimeter Institute, and I'm going to be talking to them about a thought experiment that I've been working on with Lee. And after that, I may go talk to my friends CJ and Eleonora about what they think about it, because they're string theorists, and so they see things very differently. Yesterday, I was basically reading papers and on Skype for most of the day talking to a collaborator at the University of Kentucky. And so we were chatting on Skype and exchanging papers back and forth, and I'm trying to come up with a way to think about something. And I would say I was in front of the computer for a good 3 or 4 hours yesterday doing that. It really depends on what's on your plate for the day. So a couple of weeks ago, from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m., I was at a conference every day for 5 days, which was a little bit of overkill. But it pretty much happens at every physics conference. So when there wasn't a talk that I wanted to see during the day, I actually have a PlayStation Portable. And I had it modified so that I can read PDF files on it. And so if I was in a talk that was a little bit boring, I would read scientific papers. A lot of people thought I was playing video games. And this is the downside of having a PSP and people not being aware that you can have them modded. Or I would go into another room and I would look at a paper and chat with people. So it really sort of depends. But a lot of it does involve actually going and having conversations with people and then going back and trying a calculation. And then going back and having another conversation with someone and saying, OK, I tried this calculation and it's not working, or I tried that idea that you suggested I try and it didn't work. Let's talk about it again. So a lot of it is doing calculations, getting informed, and talking to other people. I don't know if that answers your question.
Pretty much.
OK. Are there any other questions? How many of you think you're going to how many of you think you'll major in physics in college?
Don't know yet.
Sure.
In which university did you suggest for someone to study engineering?
At the undergraduate level, the physics curriculum is fairly standardized across the board.
In terms of professors and
so the thing is that at the undergraduate level, one of the most crucial aspects of making a decision about an undergraduate institution is how good the teaching is. And having a Nobel Prize winner doesn't mean that they're going to be good at teaching you physics. And that's what's going to be important. When you come out of your bachelor's degree, it's like, do you know how to do physics? Not whether the professor's name on your transcript is like Steve Weinberg. So I would say when you're looking at making decisions about undergraduate institutions, and I think this is true in pretty much any area of physics or any area of academia, that you want to look not just at the names on the paper, but also get a sense of are the students in the physics department there happy? When you talk to them, do they say, I really like my classes, I really like my professors? My professors are accessible. Like, if I have a question after class, do they actually take the time to stop and talk to me, or are they always rushing you out trying to run away from the students? Because that happens. I think when you're looking at graduate schools, it then becomes more important, like who's there and what kind of research they're in. But again, when you're picking potential PhD advisors, you're not just going to be looking at, are they a big name? You're going to be looking at, do they work in a way that I can work with them? Do we think similarly? Will we be able to get along? It's a very intense relationship, your relationship with your PhD advisor. Is this person never around? Am I okay with them not being around? Do I want someone who's there all the time? So if you want someone who's there all the time, you'll probably pick junior faculty and not someone who's a big name. If you want someone who is friendly to you doing outreach while you're a graduate student, then you're probably going to want to pick one of the professors who's involved in the outreach program at their school, because they will obviously be much nicer about you taking the time to go and do that. So there are a lot of factors that go into it, and it's not just the name. I think certainly going to an Ivy League or Cambridge University or Oxford University, it helps. Basically whatever job you apply to afterwards is going to say, okay, this person went to an Ivy League or whatever. But there's actually an undergraduate from Harvard who's here at PI as a summer school student. And I was talking to him about a month ago, and I mentioned this professor that I met at the National Society of Black Physicists this year, Vinny Manoharan, and I was saying how cool Vinny seemed and that he was probably a really good teacher because he seemed really interested in it. And he said, oh yeah, Vinny's class is the only class I've taken so far that I actually felt was worth the time. He's going to have a Harvard degree at the end of it, but for the most part, his physics classes sucked. And that was, for the most part, my experience as well. So the point is, it's a big name, but maybe the physics students aren't getting as much out of the courses as they could be, because Harvard Physics doesn't hire for teaching skill at all. All they care about is whether you're a big name and like what kind of research that you've done. So if you're someone who really wants to be at a school where they focus on actually talking to the students and engaging the students, you might want to look at one of the smaller schools. Caltech is a good place to look at, Harvey Mudd, which a lot of people haven't heard of, but is just as intense as Caltech. It's also a science school in Southern California. A lot of the small liberal arts colleges in the US. If you're in Canada, the system's a little bit different. You don't have that kind of flexibility of being picky and choosy about what the college the universities are like.
Can you think Caltech and what the other school again?
Harvey Mudd.
How do you spell it?
H-A-R-V-E-Y. And Mudd is M-U-D-D. Okay. And it's one of the, it's part of the Claremont Consortium in Claremont, California. And the kids I know who went there had a great time. It's a very small school, but they had a really good time. But the point is that when you're making decisions about schools, you basically have to make a decision about how your learning style is going to interact with the school, and also where you can get in and what you can afford and all of that. I'm sorry?
How do you know that? Like, having to just look at the school and be like, okay, well, my learning is not here.
Well, so you go visit the school, you go to a lecture and say, okay, and you ask the students, was that lecture typical of what your courses are like? And if they say yes and you didn't like the lecture, then maybe the class had 500 people in it and the professor didn't seem to like to take questions and you want to be able to ask questions in your lecture, right? Then you know, I want to ask questions in lecture and the professors here don't do that.
Do you think it's better to go to an Ivy League university or like go to a university where the professors are good and like all the lectures interest you?
I think that's a very personal choice. It really depends on what you want out of it. Like, if you want that flexibility that comes with an Ivy League degree and you're able to survive the crapshoot that is like Ivy admissions, hang on. And actually we have to wrap up soon, but can I go over like 5 minutes? I'm okay. Then If it really matters to you to have that Ivy League degree, then like that's what really matters to you. If it really matters to you to be at a small school where you know there will be 10 people in your class and all of your professors will know your name and care about whether you're learning the material or not, then like an Ivy League is almost definitely not the place for you. But that's a personal choice. Like I can't tell you what would be better for you or not. You're the one who, basically, at the end of the day, like, you know, all of you are going to talk to your parents about applying to university, and your parents are going to, like, depending on, like, what your family's like or whatever, are going to exercise various points of, like, attempts to control that decision. If it's safe to do this in your family, it's worth reminding them that you're the one who has to live through it, not them, and you're the one who has to live with the decision for the rest of your life, not them. Of course, they'll probably say we're paying for it, but again, you're still the one who has to live through it, right? So it's worth keeping that in mind as you make the decision. Yeah.
Okay, I'm back to this question because like, oh yeah, what's better, the Ivy League school or school that like teachers like and stuff? You kind of did. You went like after your graduation, I don't know. You said like there was like some things you really liked about it, and then you were saying like, oh yeah, you should go someplace where it's good for you, kind of thing. Would you still now? Would you have still gone to Harvard, or did you have gone to like smaller school that you?
You know, I actually didn't go to Harvard because of the name. My trajectory to Harvard. My trajectory to Harvard was a very strange one. So I definitely wanted to. I knew I was going to go to college. I knew I wanted to go to graduate school. I was one of those kids who was very hyperactive about it. Like when I was 10 or 11, had already sort of made my list and. I went to a magnet school. I went to a public school, but I went to a magnet, so I picked a magnet school that had good admissions history with top schools. But I was absolutely not going to apply to Harvard because, generally speaking, I have a big problem with elitism, and you know, Harvard is home base for that sort of stuff. And it really is. Like now that I've actually gone there, I can say that as an informed person. So I was telling my stepmother my list of schools that I was going to apply to, and she said, how come Harvard's not on your list? And I said, well, you know, it's a big elitist school, and I don't want to deal with that crap for 4 years, and I don't want to be that kind of person. And she said, well, I really think that you should give it a second look. And what I did is I went and I looked at the website for the Center for Astrophysics, which is worth mentioning that, yes, it says Harvard Smithsonian, but there are 300 astrophysicists who work there, and like 20 of them are employed by Harvard. Almost all of them actually work for the federal government of the United States, and they're the reason that it's such a good astronomy department, not the Harvard side. And I thought the Center for Astrophysics was very attractive. I thought this will be a place where I will get to try my hand at pretty much any kind of research in astronomy that I want to do. And so my stepmother talked my dad into letting me go to Boston by myself for a day as my 16th birthday present. And so I went up and I wandered around. And Harvard Square is beautiful. It's just a beautiful place. Now, I'll tell you, I went to the admissions office and I went on one of the tours and I was by myself. I was the only kid of color in the room. I was the only one there who wasn't with a set of parents. And I was the only one there who wasn't wearing khakis, basically. I stood out like a sore thumb and they looked at me like I stood out like a sore thumb. And it made me very uncomfortable, and I came out of it going, like, God, if this is what it's like, I don't want to be here. And then I made the mistake of walking to the Center for Astrophysics and checking it out, and I was just totally seduced by it. So in some sense, my decision was basically because of the Center for Astrophysics, and that had more to do with the Smithsonian than Harvard. Obviously, it helped that I knew that Harvard was considered a good school. But the name was actually not what attracted me to it. Yeah. I'm probably one of the few people who's going to answer like that. So to be fair, it's not a representative answer, probably. Mm-hmm. One more question, then we should probably stop. Yeah.
Then are there Ivy League schools with good physics education?
The impression that I get, actually, is that Princeton puts a lot more money into its undergraduate programs mm-hmm. than Harvard does. Like, they spend more money per undergraduate student than Harvard does.
Where?
Princeton. And their classes are smaller, and they seem to provide more money for undergraduate research and that kind of thing. But I haven't gone to Princeton, and personally, I wouldn't move to Princeton. So the actual city. So again, that would be sort of a personal thing. I can think of like maybe 3 or 4 ISSYP students who have gone to Princeton. So I don't know if there's a network of some kind for alums to contact currents, but there might be a way to get in touch with them and ask how they like it.
We're working on that, the alumni.
Okay, well, thank you for basically.